Today, going up or going down? Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 12th of January 2019. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And in this edition of the Property Imperative Weekly, we look at the latest digest of finance and property news. And after a very quiet couple of weeks over the Christmas and New Year period, things are beginning to hot up now. For example, earlier in the week, BankWest said that they had cut their interest rates by around 18 basis points on some of their fixed rate loans. And they'd also made a few other changes which would effectively reduce the cost of new loans below an LVR of 80%. Now, that's all about trying to attract new borrowers in with low rates. But on the other hand, later in the week, the Bank of Queensland announced that it would raise interest rates by up to 18 basis points on all existing loans. And they referred specifically to the higher funding costs and pressures on bank deposits. Now, this is of no surprise, because the bank bill swap rate is elevated again, and we expect other banks to follow suit. And indeed, a day or two later, Virgin Money also hiked interest rates, which is not surprising given the tie-in between Virgin Money and the Bank of Queensland. The fact of the matter is that most banks in Australia are sitting on margin compression of somewhere between 15 and 20 basis points. And so I think it's only a matter of time before we see more banks beginning to lift rates. And it highlights again the tension between offering low attractor rates to new borrowers and back book repricing for existing borrowers, many of whom will find it hard to switch away to other lenders. So to be clear, loyalty is in no way being rewarded at the moment. And that's pretty consistent across the industry. Now, on Friday, the Australian Bureau of Statistics released the retail turnover data to November. And in fact, in seasonally adjusted terms, it was 0.4%, which was a slight increase on the October figure. And they pointed to a rise in online transactions thanks to Black Friday and other pre-Christmas activity. But that said, the more reliable trend estimate showed that retail turnover only rose 0.2% in November, and that follows the 0.2% rise in October. Now, the trend data, state by state, showed that there was more momentum in Queensland and the ACT, whilst momentum was ebbing away in New South Wales. So in a way, the retail data gave some positive news, and that was taken by the market, but also some negative news. And if you look at the different categories, again in trend terms, you can see that clothing, footwear and personal accessories was a little stronger, whereas department stores and cafes, restaurants and takeaway food was a little less positive. But the really interesting piece of data, which was hardly reported in any of the media, is retail turnover per capita. So this is telling us about what individual households are doing. And the quarterly percentage change, on average, over the last year, was up 1%. So this tells you that real households are not actually spending much more at the shops. And that's one reason why a number of retailers have put out profit warnings in recent days. Now, another piece of data that came out during the week was dwelling approvals for November. And here, the ABS told us that they fell by 2.3% in November in trend terms. And this continues the pattern that we've seen recently, where building approvals are on the slide. And if you look at the different categories, the bulk of the slide is in dwelling units that are not houses. In other words, apartments, and particularly high-rise apartments. But we can also see that house approvals are a little down. And bearing in mind that there is a lead time of somewhere between 12 and 24 months between an approval and properties available, this tells us that we are going to see less supply coming into the market, less building activity, and therefore the construction metrics will continue to go negative. So perhaps it's no surprise that the HIA immediately leapt on the stats and blamed the banks for tightening too far. Now, my argument there is it's not the fact that the banks are now too tight. Previously, they were lending too loose and were breaking the law. So, in a way, any call for the banks to turn on the lending taps again is flying in the face of the fact that they are now obeying the responsible lending laws that came into effect as long ago as 2009. And they did actually highlight something which we're seeing in the data as well, and that is that it's taking quite a lot longer for housing loan approvals to come through the system and get approved. And our own data suggests that more than 40% of loan applications are still being rejected, compared with 5% a year ago. Now, the HIA ended their release by saying, "We've long been anticipating the current downturn in new home building, but there is a risk that it could develop more quickly and strongly than expected." And of course, they also signalled the potential risks relating to the outcomes from the Royal Commission, which is now going to be released in just a few weeks. And now, turning to the property market, it's still very much early days in 2019, but already CoreLogic is reporting further home price falls. And in fact, our own data is also showing that house prices are continuing to slide and the rate of slide seems to be increasing. According to CoreLogic, over the last week, prices fell 0.27% in Sydney, 0.35% in Melbourne, 0.09% in Brisbane, 0.13% in Adelaide, 0.24% in Perth, and across the five capital cities, that was an average of 0.26%. And they also updated their declines from the most recent peak, with Sydney now on average reporting an 11.5% drop, Melbourne a 7.6% drop, Brisbane 0.4%, no change in Adelaide, and 15.9% in Perth, giving us an average across the five capital cities of down 7.5%. Now, it's worth saying that those are average falls. And if you look at the postcode level data, you will see that in some postcodes, prices have slid significantly further. For example, in some postcodes around Campbelltown and Liverpool in Western Sydney, prices have fallen more than 20%. And we've also noticed similar falls in some of the urban outskirts around Melbourne. And apartments in Brisbane are also on the slide. So averages really don't tell you very much. Now, I caught up with Edwin Almeida this week, and we discussed the prospects for the next 2 or 3 months in the property market, and specifically the view that we both hold that the number of listings that will come back on the market will be quite strong. My surveys highlight that there are a number of vendors who are now definitely going to put their property in the market, and many of those are property investors, some being driven by the need to switch to principal and interest loans rather than interest-only loans, others driven by the fact that they cannot see any future growth in capital values. And we're also seeing some households who are struggling with their finances more generally. And you can watch our show, Preparation, Presentation and Marketing, where Edwin discusses some simple steps that people who may be thinking of taking their property to market should take before they start the process. Now, there was some further developments on the Opal Tower issue during the week, with, of course, some residents being told that they could perhaps move back in quite soon. But nevertheless, there was an article in the Financial Review which said that banks won't lend for Opal Tower apartment buys as a 16% loss is estimated. But my perspective on the Opal Tower is that there is still potentially more issues to unravel, not least the questions relating to the land around the time of the Olympics. There are still further questions to be asked and answered. And they actually go right back to the period before the Olympics, when the land was being reclaimed. And there was an interesting picture in the press showing just what the land was like before all the reclamation and before the construction. And so the real question is there more here than just a few cracks halfway up a tower? We probably don't know yet, but I wouldn't be surprised to see more coming out in the weeks and months ahead. And of course, as we've said in an earlier post, the chances are there are other buildings that also have risks attached to them. Elsewhere this week, the Productivity Commission released their latest report into the superannuation sector. And it really makes very damning reading. Essentially, they call out a whole bunch of reasons why many people with superannuation funds are paying fees that are too high, are getting returns that are too low, are paying for products that they don't need, and very importantly, the returns from the industry funds, which are not-for-profit funds, many of which are associated with the union movement, outperform the retail funds, which are those that are owned and managed by the commercial sector, many of whom are big banks or other financial players. And the difference in outcomes over a life can be absolutely amazing. If you're in the wrong fund, you could end up with half of what you could get if you're in the right fund. I made a show specifically on the key recommendations and the main facts. And you can watch that show, What's Super About Superannuation, for more information. But I have to say that in my mind, the whole model of superannuation that we've got in Australia, whilst it is huge in terms of its value, $2.7 trillion, it is not serving Australians well. And indeed, even the regulators were called out again for being more concerned with the industry players than the outcomes of individual savers. Frankly, I think we need some significant changes if we're going to make superannuation work for real Australians. At the moment, I think it's going in the wrong direction. Now, turning to household finances in more detail, we released our mortgage stress data to the end of December. And despite the fact that the RBA data showed there was a very slight fall in total household debt to income, our research shows that more households than ever, well over 1 million households, are now in mortgage stress. And the high level of debt that households have explain why it is that mortgage stress is so significant. Now, of course, we measure stress in cash flow terms, money in and money out, and we use our household surveys to derive the data. And you can watch our video, Mortgage Stress is Breaking More Households, where we went through the results in detail. But the key message to take away is that the household finances of many Australians are really under the gun at the moment, thanks to flat incomes, rising costs, and big mortgages. And we estimate that more than 62,000 households risk 30-day default over the next year. And that's enough to put a further dent in home prices. Now, we also released our Household Financial Confidence Index to the end of December. And this is a gauge of how households are feeling about their financial situation. And the overall index fell again in December to an all-time low of 87.3, which I have to say is a bit strange given the government's assertion that the economy is in fine fettle. Now, one of the most fascinating pieces of analysis that we do is to look at households' confidence by their wealth segments. So, for example, households who have no mortgage but own property mortgage-free have a higher level of financial confidence. It's those with mortgages who's seeing confidence levels fall. And interestingly, property investors are less confident now than even those households with no property at all, which is a remarkable turnaround from a year or 18 months ago. And you can watch our video, Household Finances Are Shot, where we walk through the data in detail. Now, this week we've started to get the first flow of information in the new year, and the latest edition of the World Bank Global Economics Prospects Report said that global growth is moderating as the recovery in trade and manufacturing activity loses steam. This is very different from their report a year ago. And they also called out the trade tensions amongst the major economies. And the key point they made was that global growth is set to fall, and it's projected now 0.3% lower than was previously projected. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that, which they go through. And they highlight the fact that whilst we had quite a positive view of growth a year ago, now, a year later, things are looking less positive. And they also said that the projected gradual deacceleration of global economic activity over the forecast horizon could be more severe than currently expected, given the predominance of substantial downside risks. A sharper than expected tightening of global financing conditions or a renewed rapid appreciation of the US dollar could exert further downward pressure on activity. So, a pretty salutary warning from the World Bank. Now, there was an interesting article by Damien Bowie, who made the point that central bankers seem to wax and wane on their positions relating to central bank balance sheet reductions. For example, after suggesting recently that balance sheet reductions need not be on, quote, autopilot, Fed Chair Powell has come back saying that the Fed's balance sheet still requires substantial reduction. It will end up being large by historical standards, but substantially lower than its recent peak. Perhaps with equity markets turning round of late, his conviction has increased that the economy will not slow too sharply, enabling the Fed to be patient without reversing its tightening trajectory. Indeed, he also suggested that he does not see recession in 2019. And the Fed's Evans also noted the market's fascination with balance sheet reduction as a key risk to the outlook rather than just rates. And interestingly, the ECB minutes revealed that officials are toying with the idea of introducing another targeted long-term repo operation to shore up liquidity in the system and to cope with slowing growth. So Bowie says that in the US economy, there is no doubt that there's been a tightening of financial conditions associated with widening credit spreads, weakness in equities, flattening yields curves, and US dollar strength. But other moving parts have offered powerful offsets. For one, real wages growth has accelerated, partly because of falling oil prices. Bank lending standards have eased, according to the November US survey. And in the real economy, job creation has been very strong. So the net balance of these forces is consistent with slower growth but not a recession. But, he says, there are a few factors that could tip the balance to the downside. Firstly, fiscal fade. So he said, we're now passing peak levels of deficit spending. To be sure, deficits continue and the stock of government debt continues to rise, but the delta on GDP growth from smaller deficit flows is negative. And secondly, trade disruptions in 2018. Investors focused on the negative effects of protectionism on emerging markets via the channel of capital flows. In 2019, the focus has now returned to the impact of protectionism on US corporates via supply chain disruption and margin squeeze. That's one reason why Apple's share price has recently taken a drive. So he concludes that overall the Fed still seems inclined to tighten, whether through rates or balance sheet reduction, or indeed both. And the ECB seems unwilling to do an about-face on its balance sheet plans. And the world real yield curve remains inverted, even as everyone's thinking evolves. Risk has not materially fallen yet, even though we know push come to shove what central banks must do to tackle a serious problem. So my take on all this is that it's not clear yet precisely where the global economy, or indeed the US economy, is going. There are lots of countervailing forces. And indeed, we've seen the stock markets begin to move up again from their lows just after Christmas. The real question, to my mind, is the rate of further increase that the Feds may impose. But it's worth recalling that the latest dots chart still shows more rate rises ahead. And so now to our market roundup. Starting in Australia, the ASX ended 0.35% down on Friday to end at 4,769, having staged a reasonable recovery from its lows after Christmas. The positive retail figures probably provided some support. The local volatility index, or fear index, was down another 2.20% to end at 1485, well off recent highs, but still in areas of relatively high risk and volatility. The ASX financials was down 0.67% to 5,642, but has recovered a little from its earlier lows. And if you look amongst the majors, ANZ was down 0.36% on Friday to end at 25.24. The CBA was down 1.09% to end at 71.66. National Australia Bank was down 0.2% to end at 24.55. Westpac Banking Corporation was down 0.93% to 25.61. Amongst the regionals, the Bank of Queensland was up 0.20% to end at 10.26. They, of course, announced a lift in their mortgage rates. Suncorp Group fell 1.45% to end at 12.20. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank fell 0.73% to end at 10.84. And the AMP fell 0.78% to end at 2.54 and is still languishing. Macquarie Group was down 0.65%, having seen a bit of a recovery over recent days, to end at 113.21. partly because of its international business portfolios. And Genworth, the mortgage lender's insurer, was down 1.4% to end at 2.12 and is near its lows, reflecting both risks in the mortgage sector and also reflecting recent changes in the financial markets. Mortgage Choice, the mortgage aggregator, was up 0.53% to end at 95 cents, but is still well down and again reflects risks in the mortgage sector. Now, the Australian dollar was up to 72.22, which was up 0.09% on Friday, having recovered above 70 cents. But it's more to do with weakness in the US dollar than the strength of the Australian economy. The spot gold Aussie dollar cross was down 0.35% to end at 1,784. And the Bitcoin Aussie dollar cross was up 1.4% to end at 4,861. But that's more to do with exchange rate movements than it is the underlying Bitcoin, as we'll see a little later. And now switching to the US, the Dow Jones was down just a little, 0.02%, to end at 23,995.95. So the markets were helped by more optimism regarding the China-US trade talks and the expectations of a slow pace of interest rate hikes from the Federal Reserve. The S&P 100 was pretty flat to end at 1,149, again having recovered from its previous lows. And the S&P 500 was, again, pretty flat to end at 2,596. The FEAR, or Volatility Index, was down 6.72% to 1819, well off its highs, but still in an elevated risk area. And the S&P 500 Financials was up 0.17% to end at 406.70. And Goldman Sachs was up 0.53% to 176.93, again recovering a little bit from the lows earlier on, but still well down. Turning to the tech index, the Nasdaq Composite was down 0.21% to end at 6,971.48. Apple was down 0.98% to 152.29. Google was down 1.33% to end at 1,064. Amazon was down 0.95% to end at 1,640. And Facebook was down 0.28% to end at 143.80. Intel was up 0.76% to end at 48.93. And so what's interesting is the focus is really now turning on the performance of some of these big tech firms and their exposure specifically to China and other markets and their prospective growth rates ahead in a potentially slowing economy. The 10-year bond rate was down 1.18% to 2.69%. And you can see that that's well down from its highs, but above its low recently at the end of last year. And the three-month rate stands at 2.42, down 0.46%, but showing, of course, that the relationship between the short-term and the longer-term bonds is getting tighter. The US dollar trade index was up 0.13% to 95.66, having slid in recent times. And thinking of Brexit, the British pound US dollar was down 0.08% to end at 1.28, to end at 1.2852. And of course, this coming week, we will get the next Brexit vote. The FTSE 100 was down 0.36% to 6,918, and again shows the same trend of a small recovery from the early January lows. The FTSE 350 Financial Services Index was up 0.29% to 645.66. And the Euro-US dollar was up 0.02% to end at 1.1469. Deutsche Bank, who I still regard as a bellwether stock, was down again 0.07% to 7.489. And the Chinese yuan US dollar was up 0.38% to end at 0.1479. The crude oil futures was down 1.69% to end at 51.70, having seen a recent improvement in the last week or so. Gold futures was up 0.03% to 1,287. Silver was down 0.05% to 1,563. And copper was up 0.70%. to 265. And the Bitcoin US dollar was down 0.15% to 3,707, and it still languishes at the bottom of its recent range. Now, our own view of what's happening with the market is that we're going to see more volatility ahead, but it's unlikely that we're going to see a crash from this point. More likely, we're going to go sideways for a bit. There may well be some more positive news with regard to trade. We suspect that the Federal Reserve will hold off raising rates ahead for at least a little while. and probably Washington will sort itself out with regard to funding its operations. So more likely than not, we're going to see the markets continue to move into positive territory through the first 3 months of 2019. But later in the year, we think things will become more testing again. And meanwhile, locally, we're going to see the impact of home price falls continuing to flow through. What I find fascinating is that many of the commentators are still talking bullishly about the performance of our banks, despite the falls of home prices. And that's because most of the analysts believe that the banks ultimately hold the cards when it comes to pricing power. So they can and they will lift mortgage rates if they need to maintain their margins. Personally, I'm less convinced of that for three simple reasons. Firstly, funding costs will remain under pressure. Secondly, we think that at some point the banks are going to have to mark their portfolios to market to take account of the falling property values. Now, what point they do that is going to be the question. But when they do, that's going to have quite a significant impact, both in terms of losses and indeed capital requirements. And thirdly, we still think that there is going to be lower momentum in the lending sector ahead, not least because of the new tighter standards that are still in place, and also the fact that just demand for loans will continue to fade away as more people decide not to buy now, but to wait and see what happens in the months ahead. And that's the point, really. If prices are set to continue to slide, then there is absolutely no reason to buy now. You can buy later and get something cheaper and perhaps even closer in to town. So I think there'll be more uncertainty ahead, and of course we'll be reporting that on the Digital Finance Analytics blog. Now before I go, a couple of reminders. Firstly, next Tuesday, the 15th of January at 8 p.m. Sydney time, we're running our next live stream. Do feel free to join the live chat or send me a question beforehand via the YouTube channel or via the DFA blog. And if you get benefit from these posts, please do consider supporting our activity. You can do that via our Patreon program, here's the link, or by making a direct contribution via PayPal. And here's a link to that too. And finally, do leave a comment or a question. I do read them all. And if you haven't subscribed so far, please do so to receive alerts when we release new posts. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.